Cosmic Shed. Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. Today's episode is all about Blue Planet 2. And there's much excitement at the shed because today in the shed I am joined by
Maddie
and
Steve.
And we have some people in the shed who I'll introduce you to in a moment.
It's very crowded.
It is. It's the busiest shed we've ever had, I think. But we have had some questions in from Mrs. Howarth's Year 8 Geography class from Haslingden High School. So, hello, Mrs. Howarth's Year 8 Geography class. And thank you for your questions, which are excellent. And those questions, along with some others, will be put to our guests from Blue Planet 2.
My name is John Chambers, and I was an assistant producer in the series. I mostly worked on the Green Seas episode that just went out on Sunday night.
And my name's Alex Vale, and I was one of the camera operators on Blue Planet 2, mostly working on Green Seas and the Coral Reef episode.
My name's Sophie Morgan. I was a researcher on the series, and I worked on Green Seas and Coasts mainly.
John, Alex, Sophie, welcome to the Cosmic Shed.
It's lovely.
It's lovely. Yeah,
it's very nice.
Very cozy. Yeah.
It's getting warmer too.
Yeah, it is warmer. Yeah.
Trust the Aussies to bring the temperature up.
So I think I know what a camera operator does. I think I know what a researcher does, but maybe you could explain it a little bit more after John tells us what an assistant producer does.
There's a lot of overlap with this. We had a very big team, but we had an awful lot of things to film, so we all ended up doing each other's jobs quite a lot. But in general, an assistant producer preps field direct sequences and comes back and then preps another sequence and field directs that. And so put the story together, go out into the field, capture the images.
You said about stories. Are the episodes storyboarded in advance?
You know, actually, on this series, we did storyboards like you would have for a movie or a commercial. And that seems silly because how can you storyboard animals? But you always go out with what you hope the sequence will be. You're going for a specific behaviour usually. Mm-hmm. So by storyboarding it, it just focuses you on what the story beats are, you know, what specific shots you want. And, you know, just the kind of coverage that you need to get that sequence.
Okay, so that dictates where you go and what you point the cameras at to some extent?
Well, I mean, you storyboard after you know where you're going to go.
Okay.
And you write out all the story beats that you think this behaviour or this animal is going to have. And then you visualise it. And you think, what's the best way to film this? What camera angles do we want? Where do we want the camera to be placed? All of those kind of things. And sometimes, you know, the sequence comes back looking like the storyboards, and sometimes it comes back looking absolutely nothing like them because you can't predict nature. But it's a very useful starting point for us.
Okay.
And how long does it take to kind of go from having, like, the storyboard to being like, okay, yeah, we've got enough footage to capture that?
Well, how long is a piece of string? It really depends. Sometimes you work on a sequence for a year before you go out to film it. You hear Sophie's probably the best person to talk about this. She was an absolutely brilliant researcher on the series. She found some of the most iconic sequences in the series, but some of them come together very quickly, and others you're digging for details and digging for the best way to do it and just trying to find out, is this crazy thing true? So sometimes it's very fast, sometimes it takes a long time.
Sophie, you're the researcher, so as I understand it, that means you're looking for stories and then going out and chasing them, telling them where to find them.
A bit of that. I mean, I was on the series for 3 years, so I was lucky enough over that time to be let loose on a few sequences myself. But generally, the researcher spends a lot of time reading papers, on the phone to scientists, on the phone to, you know, in our instance, divers, fishermen, sailors, anyone who's on the water to, you know, find stories and then find out if a story is filmable. Something might sound great on paper, but if it doesn't work visually and you have to explain it, it's not a good story.
Yeah, okay. Noah. So Noah found the scene featuring the octopus and the group of fish incredible. And he'd like to know whether that you knew that was the behaviour you were looking for, or did it surprise you when you found it?
So that's a great question, Noah, but I'm going to hand that over to Alex Vale, who was instrumental in discovering and filming that story.
So yeah, so the cooperative hunting between the grouper and the octopus, that was actually, funnily enough, that was my PhD research.
All right.
That we based that on. So yeah, I did my PhD working on cooperative hunting, basically, and these grouper fish, they hunt with moray eels as well. And so well, we'd actually only seen the hunting between the grouper and the octopus. I'd seen it 5 times in my life, and I actually used to live out on a little island on the Great Barrier Reef. My parents are the directors of the research station out there, so we hadn't seen it very often for being out on the reef a lot of times. But so one of the first things that we did, you know, when Jonathan and Yoli, who was the producer and the researcher on that show, decided that, yes, you know, we'd like to try and film this sequence, was myself and Lexi and Grace, my two assistants. We went out and we just spent a lot of time following these gropers around and just started to work out, like, what times of the day does this happen? Are there particular octopus that they like to do it more with? A certain octopus more relaxed around divers? And we just learned a lot about it, and that's sort of what it made it possible to, you know, film this sequence on them.
Yeah, because when I'm watching it, I'm thinking, how much of it is really clever filmmaking,
mm-hmm.
and how much, if you were in the water with them, can you definitely see them working together?
Certainly, like, you, it's when it happens, like the signalling by the grouper, it's really obvious. Like, there are some times when it'll do it sort of half-heartedly and it doesn't look like that much at all, but when it really gets into it, when it's really doing its little headstand signal, it is so obvious, and it's the most unusual sort of thing that you'll see. This fish, like, head down, tail up, twitching away like crazy, and then this octopus swims over to it. Like, if you're watching a good event, it's pretty, you can really see there's something unusual going on.
Okay. And that octopus that we saw in the Green Seas episode, didn't you have something to do with that, John?
Yeah, we worked on that for a long time. Myself and Roger Horrigs, who's a South African cameraman, he's based in Cape Town. We were looking for a story in the kelp forests near Cape Town for a long time. And we loved all of the different, you know, creatures that are in there. You know, the pajama sharks, the octopus, you know, such a great collection of characters down there. But we couldn't find, you know, we couldn't find our way in to tell a good story, a good sequence in there. And that actually came from a man called Craig Foster, who Roger knows very well. And Craig has been snorkeling every morning in a pair of bicycling shorts.
Yeah.
He's into cold water immersion. He gets into the water and he swims in the cold waters in False Bay every morning for 45 or 50 minutes.
Oh, wow.
But through the course of that, he found the most amazing behaviours. And he actually was able to track the octopus. And he had previously spent a lot of time in the Kalahari with, you know, tribes that were tracking up there. And he started to apply the tracking techniques that he had seen above land in the water. And your first reaction to that is, how on earth is that possible? You're underwater. And initially he was following things like slime trails of, you know, mollusks and things that were down there. And eventually he got to the point where he was able to find this one female octopus, which it was in the sequence on Sunday, by tracking its kills. So you would see Craig swimming around in the kelp forest, picking up shells, holding him up to the light, checking if the hole was circular or an oval shape. If it was an oval shape, it was the prey of the octopus.
Yeah.
And he was actually able to go round and find it. Me and Roger would be in the water and we would have no idea how to find anything.
Yeah.
The story really came from Craig every morning swimming for 50 minutes and just getting to know this environment and getting to know the characters that were in there. So Roger came to me and said, Craig has really got to know this female octopus who can do the most amazing things. And what he told me wasn't everything we saw in the sequence, you know. There were other things. He's a master of the skies, you know, can change colour and texture, so it can hide that way. It can squeeze into, you know, any crack or crevice. It's literally the animal's beak, which is the limiting factor there. It can squeeze into anything. In those kelp forests, it actually wraps itself in kelp, making a little armoured protective ball. So we went down knowing that this was a very smart predator, but also a very smart piece of prey, because one of the things about the kelp forest in South Africa is that there's 100 species of sharks down there. Okay. You know, everything from the great white, you know, down to the pajama sharks that we featured in the sequence. So we went down, then we actually decided, because it was going to take so long to kind of get to know this octopus, that Craig and Roger would film it remotely. So they had been filming for a year by the time I went down there for 3 weeks. And on my very first dive with the octopus, we're swimming back to shore and a shark grabs the octopus and pulls it out and starts shaking it around. And I thought, I can't believe it, I'm a jinx, I've arrived. And the lead character of the sequence is getting eaten before my eyes. I couldn't believe it. And I went down, I had a closer look, and we actually saw that the octopus, as you saw in the sequence, had its arms through the gills off the shark. And Craig had never seen that, Roger had never seen that. I don't think anyone had seen that behaviour before.
It's amazing.
And you know, the shark let the octopus go and the octopus got out of there as fast as it could. Yeah.
Sorry, is that kind of the intelligence that shows, is that because it's tried that out, it's tried different positions with its eight legs and, or arms, whatever they are, and found that that's worked, or does it know that that's how it breathes, though it's specifically doing that?
I don't think there's any way for us to know that, but they are incredibly smart animals, and they don't just have 1, 2, 3, 4 ways to escape predators down there. They've got a whole host of ways that they can do it, and depending on the situation they try something else, whether it's squirting and disappear or, you know, change colour and hide, or, you know, as we saw at the end of the sequence, you know, create a suit of armour out of the shells and rock in the seabed. So I don't think there's any way we can know what's going through that octopus's, you know, brain.
Yeah.
Does it know that it's going to, you know, starve the shark of oxygen and force it to release it? But who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
It certainly looks as though it could be thinking that. I mean, they seem that intelligent. Can you see it? So you're talking about a particular individual. Are there other octopuses around that you're seeing that are a bit more stupid? Or are they...
They are absolutely individual. And this particular female, Craig got to know very well and follow around. But you do see different octopus and they behave very differently and they have their own personalities. You know, some never come out to see you because, you know, they're probably threatened by a large diver or snorkeler coming past it, but they're completely individual.
Mm. Right. Alex, you were doing a PhD in cooperative hunting. Does that mean we've got you to thank for the false killers and the dolphins?
No, I didn't have anything to do with that one, actually. It was all pretty much on the coral grouper and octopus and morays, basically.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which was amazing.
Yeah, no, really amazing. Sophie, you were looking at scientific papers, which is one of my favourite things to do.
Yes.
It's pretty good fun, isn't it? What did you find then? What did you find in a scientific paper which we have then seen on our screens?
Oh, the difficult thing is there's this really good story that I found on a scientific paper that will be on Coasts next week on Sunday.
Okay.
So I'm not allowed to talk about that one yet.
Okay, fair enough.
Sadly. How is it? I mean, I read a lot of papers. And, you know, we read a lot of papers as well for the sea otter sequence, which you did see.
Yeah.
Amazing. Oh, they're lovely, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Honestly, I mean, John doesn't agree with me on how cute sea otters are. He's the one person that's immune to their charms.
I don't dislike sea otters, but everyone else on the planet seems to think they're the cutest animals out there. But
what is the cutest animal for you, then?
I've always loved sharks. I was obsessed by sharks as a young child, so... Yeah, I'll go with sharks, yeah.
Sorry, that does bring us to a very useful question, which we always get from our sponsor, which is Slow Brew Club Coffee, which is, are sloths the best animals ever made, yes or no?
I would say no.
Okay.
I would say no.
I just told you what the
best animals are. Sorry.
You're asking three people who are... avid divers and into marine biology, whether a sloth's the best animal.
Yeah. Although those sloths do swim sometimes. That's so true. I've seen on a documentary.
Really slowly.
Wonder who that was by.
Yeah, I wonder.
Right, okay, so just, can you tell us something that you found in a scientific paper that you wanted to see on screen and we won't see?
Yeah, actually, I can tell you something. With the sea otter sequence, one of the behaviours we looked at doing was a behaviour where the adult males will actually kidnap the babies from the mother sea otters to force them to give up their food.
Right, okay.
Savage.
Wow. Which is really, really mean.
I can see where you're coming from.
mean creature.
So essentially, mum will go down, she'll dive, the pup will be chilling out on the surface because they can't really dive, they're too buoyant, sort of having a little squeal and a sunbathe, and the big male otter will come along and literally hold it until mum comes up. And then sometimes even be quite savage with it, so it starts squealing, so mum will give up her food. Unfortunately, like being on that level with sea otters, we did see similar behaviour, but it's one, again, that it sounds really great on paper, but actually it just looks like a mass of fur and angriness at the time. So it's just not visual enough to kind of tell that story.
Yeah. And as a researcher, do you get to go on location?
Yes. Yes, okay. Lucky enough, John and I went and filmed the Weedy Sea Dragon sequence that went out.
Okay, yeah, amazing.
Thank you. And I also worked on sea otters and the giant trevally sequence in episode one as well.
Okay. Actually, I've got a question which is completely random, which has come to my head. You know the mantis sequence?
Yeah, zebra mantis.
There we go.
Biggest mantis in the world.
That's the one. Mm-hmm. How on earth did you film it underground? There was like in its burrow, or whatever it is, it's taking the food down to his wife. Let's call it his wife.
Yeah, I think that's a good name.
How do you film that?
Well, Alex and I worked on that sequence together.
Okay.
And Alex, again, this is another sequence that came from Lizard Island, where Alex had the amazing childhood growing up on this Great Barrier Reef island. So that sequence came about because Alex had seen this remarkable behaviour of these mantis shrimps, that it's straight out of a horror film. The fish swims above it and it comes up and it spears them and pulls them down into their den and they eat it. So that was all filmed by Alex, and I'll let him tell you more about that in a moment. And to me, that was some of the most exciting rushes we ever got by, because Alex did that in Lizard Island over a period of time, and he sent them back to us in Bristol.
Quite a long period of time. Because they don't do things very quickly.
Yeah, all this stuff takes a huge amount of patience, and it's amazing the different types of patience that that you have to use. Sometimes it's patience in the water, 3-4 hour dives, you know, and sometimes, like in this, it was putting cameras there to record for long periods of time, which Alex can tell you exactly how he did. But we had this amazing behaviour, but obviously you want to see what happens underground as well. So that was one sequence in the series, and there were a couple of times we did this where we actually filmed that in a tank.
Okay, cool.
But the animals were collected by scientists at the research station.
Yeah.
And we filmed them, just those shots we needed underwater, just in there, just to finish off.
Okay.
Finish off the story.
Okay, because I'm thinking that's exactly what I thought you must have done. And I'm fine with that, by the way. I don't write for that newspaper, so I'm fine.
Well, there's there are various articles online explaining how we did that and how we did the tank work in the series. But, you know, most of that sequence, as Alex will tell you now, was, you know, filmed in the water.
Yeah. So we filmed sort of all of the, you know, hunting stuff out in the wild, all of the rest of it, basically. And boy, it just took a very long time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, like, yeah, mantis shrimp, you know, they have this amazing hunting method. They have these crazy spear-like arms that they just wait there with their two little eyes, and that's another cool thing about them. They've got this crazy vision that can, you know, have all these different types of sensors in there. They can see in ways that human eyes can't see, polarized light, you know, linearly polarized light. So they just wait there with these amazing eyes poking out, just waiting for a little fish to, you know, come within 30 centimetres of them, and then just launch out and impale it. So we just had to, you know, we put out these little remote cameras, and we just waited and waited and waited, and we just sort of honed down basically our timing. So, you know, it was definitely to do with sort of certain stages of the tide, certain stages of the day, basically where you would occasionally tend to get these strikes. So yeah, we just a lot of cameras and a lot of time out there, basically.
Yeah. Amazing. There's a couple of linked questions to that, actually, which I have got from social media, so I'll find those. One is actually not specifically that, but the bobbit. Who invented the bobbit? Was it God or the devil? And if it's God, then can I please never see the death worm that the devil created?
I think that's a fair call.
I think so. Terrifying creature. Amazing, though. Amazing animal.
Yeah, you know, because we talk a lot about science fiction here in the shed.
Mm.
If you'd put that in a science fiction film, you'd think it was far-fetched.
It's quite similar in Star Wars.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is.
When I watched Star Wars, I was like, well, that would never happen. And then we've got things here on Earth which are even worse.
I couldn't believe it when I saw it.
Yeah. It's terrible. Oh, definitely.
We've discussed who made them. So, you know.
the guys who filmed that actually did an amazing job because, I mean, they tried to film it under white light and it wouldn't behave. I mean, it's a night creature. It doesn't like bright lights. And so they actually ended up for the first time using an IR infrared adapted camera and infrared lights to film that. So as you can imagine, they were down there with no light that they could see, and they could only see the bobbit worm through the monitor. Yeah. So I bet that makes it feel great.
So a linked question to that, actually, is at what depth does the Jaws theme tune hit? And once it does, is it humanly possible for it to escape your mind?
It's about 15 metres.
We did get
when I'm paddling on the surf.
We did get some proper questions.
Well, the difference with us is we're always hoping a shark's going to swim past.
While we're doing other people's questions, so here's one. Documentary filmmaking is notoriously unprofitable. True or false? And does that mean it's difficult outside of something like the BBC to make something like this?
Oh, good question.
It's a really difficult question, actually.
I don't know if I'm the person to answer it.
I mean, the BBC. I mean, working at the BBC is a great thing. I mean, I think it's not necessarily about money-wise, because I think everybody's working on similar budgets, whether you're at the BBC or outside. But the integrity that comes with the BBC means it opens the doors to scientific collaborations. You know, it's something that scientists really trust, and you know, we're a very small part, I mean, of the wheels that turn to make Blue Planet. There are so many other people and so many scientists that without them and without their help and support and often their facilities, we wouldn't have been able to make the series.
No, absolutely. I'd just like to say, when you say that, it's always worth knowing that Apollo astronauts always say they were a very small part of going to the moon. So what is it that makes that integrity? What is it that's motivating you? When we had the guys from Planet Earth 2 here, they said that the motivation for them was finding something that David Attenborough hadn't seen. Similar?
Well, I'd say Sophie's definitely a better position to answer that, finding all these amazing things.
Do you know what's great? And I think we had probably a little step ahead in terms of the Planet Earth team, because underwater technology, cameras, rebreathers, has improved so much since the days of Blue Planet 1 that, I mean, I think we filmed 25 new behaviours across the series. So I think we surprised Attenborough quite a lot. You know, and we really had the ability to do that with an underwater series. We were very lucky to be able to surprise the big man.
I made a show over the summer called The Dive Tent, where we took people into the Mariana Trench. But it was an audio adventure, because I thought we'd never, ever, ever be able to see it. We'd never be able to get cameras down there.
Yeah.
And then I watch your program.
And there it was. Yeah.
that links to, so we're in the Planet Earth 2 episode and in interviews in other media, there was a very strong sort of emphasis that Planet Earth 2 wasn't made to cash in on Planet Earth 1. It wasn't the right sort of commercial time, but it was the fact that the technology that's developed since then and now enabled so much more, and so much more immersion and sort of cinematic filming. And you mentioned rebreathers and stuff like that. What else has helped you make Blue Planet 2 what it is?
Well, I think Alex is probably a good person to talk about this. I mean, we developed a lot of new equipment, and, you know, Blue Planet 1, I don't think they even had stabilized cameras topside. You know, so obviously things like the Cineflex on boats have been used for a long time. We got some really exciting new lenses and things for them just before Blue Planet, which was great. But we developed a lot of kit. We tried to bring topside filming underwater with things like kind of grip and sliders and scope systems. And Alex really kind of was one of the people that, you know, pioneered filming with the scope system.
So there's this sort of special lens that was, you know, specifically developed for Blue Planet 2. It was one of the producers of the Reef episode, Jonathan Smith, that brought this thing on. And he's like, we're going to make this program look really different. And so what this scope lens is, it's got a really like narrow sort of front bit to it. And what that means is you can get it into all these like little tiny cracks and crevices, or down really low next to an animal where like you didn't used to be able to go, you know, you used to sort of look a little bit down on the animal, but this gets you to sort of their level or even below it. And it allows you to like even get within the branches of like a coral and things like that. So you're seeing like the world from the perspective of these little fish. And what's more, it's not just small, but like it's really macro. So you can see things up close, like a tiny little fish like fills up, you know, most of the screen. But then the extra amazing thing about it is that it's got this huge depth of field. So like a normal macro lens, like there's only a small bit that's in focus, the rest in the background, all out of focus. With the scope lens, it's all in focus, basically, all the background, all the way through. So it's just this totally different perspective. And especially like on the Coral Reef episode and in the Green Seas episode, where you're sort of going through these really like dense, complex environments, you know, using this new technology, just really gives you a whole different perspective, you know, the way a small animal would sort of see it. So that's certainly one of the technological advances that's, you know, given it a different look, for sure.
Yeah, and, you know, instead of showing you something that's happening, you're now able to put you in that, which, you know, involves you much more in it, and than we were able to do before, so.
When you put a camera on a whale, do you get it back?
Well, you have to, otherwise you will not get any of the footage. Yeah. Yeah, they pop off after a certain amount of time, and they usually seem to pop off at 1 or 2 in the morning. And then you've got the scientists and the production team having to go out in a boat and try and find them before they drift off too far. You know, it's one thing getting the cameras on the animals, but getting them off again is just as hard.
Yeah.
I think they lost one on the sequence for Reef. I think they lost one from a turtle, and it was found in a cave by a diver sort of months later.
Really?
Yeah.
No way. Was the footage any good?
I think the footage was still on the camera.
Yeah, right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice. Was a turtle watching it in the cave?
it's treasure.
This is amazing.
Got the projector out.
So how does the R&D process at the BBC work? Do you invent technologies and then find applications for them, or do you find problems and then try to solve them?
Well, so I'm probably not the best person to answer this. I pretty much that they develop these technologies, and I'm lucky enough to get to come in and operate them sometimes. So maybe one of you guys.
So it's always driven by what you want to achieve visually. You know, how can we get the cameras low? How can we get the cameras in things? You know, how can we get very precise movements? You know, and how can we get elaborate camera shots that you would have on the surface and translate those underwater? So we ended up building a lot of things. Whenever I say we, most of our equipment was built by a very talented man called Mohan Sandhu. and he builds all of our underwater grip, our scope, our motion control time-lapse system, and lots more. And Mohan's brilliant. You tell him what you want, and 9 times out of 10, he delivers it. And I think the reason he can do it is because he doesn't get scared and doesn't realise all of the massive number of problems that he's going to run into, because there was a lot of blood, sweat and tears went into absolutely everything he built for the series. And because, you know, it's never been done before, he's really starting from scratch. And not only is he starting from scratch, it's got to go underwater and not leak. Which in and of itself is very difficult. So it always starts with, what type of shots would we like to get? How could we possibly achieve this? And then having someone game enough to try to build it for us.
Cool. Are you all kind of going down when you've been in the water? You're all free diving. Is that the way you do it?
A real mix.
Yeah. Like some shoots were certainly free diving. Like did someone turtles where you basically have to, that they for some reason they just do not like scuba divers. These particular turtles anyway. Like it's not even the bubbles. You can just be there with a scuba tank on. They just don't like you being bigger for some reason. I don't know. Maybe they're jealous that you can breathe underwater. So like you have to, you know, do that on breath.
What do they do then if they don't like it? You mean they just swim away?
They just swim away. Okay. Yeah. But they'll let you get really close if you're on snorkel. Yeah. But the vast majority of the shoots are actually on rebreathers. Some of them are on scuba, but rebreathers are great technology because, you know, they've just allow, you know, the diver to not emit any bubbles. I'm not actually a rebreather diver myself, so I'm probably not the best person to talk about it. But Sophie or John
will be the one.
So rebreathers are fantastic in that it's a closed circuit diving system, which basically means no bubbles come out. And there's two real advantages for wildlife filming, and that is there's no bubbles, which are actually very noisy. Most scuba divers don't realize that because when they go underwater, that's what they always hear. But they're, you know, when you breathe out and the bubbles go out, it's a lot of noise. So they eliminate that problem, and it means you can get a lot closer to some animals. And they're happy for you to wait beside them, and hopefully something great will happen in front of the lens. And the other amazing thing about them is you can generally stay underwater for a lot longer. On scuba, depending on what depths you're at, you'll be in the water for anything from, you know, half an hour to maybe an hour and a half maximum. On rebreathers, you know, you can do 3, 4, 5 hour dives. And what that allows you is just to stay with the animals and just wait for those moments of behaviour to happen, which is, you know, if you'd been on scuba, you'd already be back in the boat, changing into a new cylinder and hopefully getting back in. So it's just time and silence, and they're a really fantastic tool just to be as unobtrusive as possible and really let the animals, you know, just behave as if you're not there.
Because there's submarines as well, right? Those are amazing.
The submarines are amazing. That I did one submarine dive on this series, but I didn't work on the deep program. Yeah. So I did one submarine dive to 1,000 meters on the whale carcass. I went back to visit the whale carcass that had been eaten by the six-gill sharks and all kinds of other things down there. And that was a real highlight for me. I've always wanted to go in a submarine, so that was probably the most exciting day on the entire series for me, because I wasn't working on the deep film. I'd always wanted to do it, and I managed to go out and do it. But they spent hundreds and hundreds of hours. Orla, Will, the whole team on deep, Joe Tredenig, they spent a huge amount of time in submersibles, and again it just gives you time down there and just gets you to depth that we can't even dream of on normal diving equipment.
And how much swearing was cut out when they tasted the water at the bottom of the submarine?
You would have to ask Orla that.
That was going to be my ask. It had that leak, didn't it? Okay, so on that note, what's the scariest thing that's happened to you underwater?
To be honest, because this is what we do for a living, you really try not to put yourself in any situation that is scary or where things go wrong. And invariably, you know, some things do happen, but generally things are planned and we've got enough contingencies in place that that things don't, because, you know, we all want to come out of there safely, so you don't push it to a place where that would happen, and, yeah. and things are all planned and have the backups and everything. So it's a very boring answer, but thankfully not very many scary things actually happen.
Yeah, apart from swimming with sharks and being 1,000 meters underwater.
Alex was giggling.
Do you know what, it's far scarier when you go down and the sharks aren't there, actually. The best thing is for the sharks to be there.
Oh, why are the sharks scared? Is that what you're saying?
No, it's just that it's really scary for us when we go out to a location and what we want to see isn't there. So we'd much rather be surrounded by sharks.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that, what scared the sharks?
No. A question that came in from Mrs. Howard's class, actually. How do you know that you're going to find things? I thought that when with the whale sequence with the... were they sperm whales that did the really deep diving?
Yes. Mm.
Yeah. In the Big Blue, right? How on earth do you find a whale? How do you know where to go to find all the things that you're doing, and how long does it take you to find them?
Well, I mean, we do so much work in the office. I mean, it's the kind of glorified part is the part we get to go in the field and spend lots of time with animals. But before every shoot, there can be, you know, sometimes up to 2 years of sort of phone bashing, and not only speaking to scientists but speaking to the people that are actually on the water, so the boat skippers, you know, the divers, the fishermen. You know, there's always a risk with wildlife, the stuff isn't going to be there, but we make it a very, very sort of educated risk. You know, there are things sometimes beyond our control, but we really ask everything, you know, to the season, the visibility, you know, what might affect the behavior, you know, what's the worst that could possibly happen. Do the whales ever kind of disappear for a few days? Hmm. What kind of boat's the best to approach them? Do they like divers? You know, we really, I guess, pride ourselves on drilling down into that, because, you know, turning up on location and not having a story to film really, really wouldn't be good.
No. The whale carcass.
The carcass was filmed on the surface originally for the Big Blue, and it was a natural death from what I understand it. It was hit by a boat, I believe.
Okay.
Natural-ish.
Yeah, exactly.
And so do you know about that because the boat tells you, or do you just, you're flying over and you see a carcass? How does that
work? I didn't work on it, but, you know, obviously we really wanted to find a whale carcass as part of the story. Yeah. So I imagine that the guys who worked in Open Ocean and Joe who worked in the deep, that they were plugged into that local network, that they were plugged into the local boat skippers and the local scientists, so that when a whale did turn up, they'd be the first people to know.
The one thing that's come up quite a bit is, because people get upset about it, the plastic and the ecological arguments and things.
I think we've got, you know, I think we want to make a great film, we want to entertain people, and we want people to love the ocean. And this region doesn't just talk about plastics, it talks about kind of all, you know, issues the ocean is going through. I think we do want to entertain people, but we sort of have a moral obligation to, you know, talk about changes in the ocean. So I think we're all very passionate about the plastics story. I mean, it's something that is more than evident whenever we go on location. You know, I was on an incredibly remote atoll filming the bird-eating fish for episode one. No one lives on it. And yet it was covered in plastic, you know, flip-flop, even refrigerators that had washed up onto this beach. And, you know, that's really just the part of the problem that you can see, you know. And then you look at microplastics, which, you know, you can't see, but are causing massive, massive problems up the food chain. And it's just, I agree, you can't talk about the great things in the ocean without talking about the problems it's facing.
But with plastic, you just can't ignore it, because unfortunately it's absolutely everywhere now. So it's not even an editorial or, you know, a decision about, do we want to show this? There's so much plastic in the oceans now, you can't avoid it.
Yeah.
So you have to show it.
Does it change the way, making this series, has it changed the way that you live your lives? Or did you already know it because you're in the seas already?
I think, you know, personally, yeah, like having been, you know, around the sea for a long time, I've always, you know, cared a lot about fish and things like that. So I think it hammers at home for sure when you're seeing these things more and more, and, you know, we're talking about them in the series. But yeah, I think that, you know, having had the privilege to grow up around the ocean, you know, it's probably not just this that's changed my opinion. But I try not to eat fish too much because I really like them.
Yeah. But yeah, sorry, just to change tack now. So Alex, you were a scientist originally.
Yeah, exactly.
And Sophie, you study science. Did you do science before this as well?
I studied zoology at Bristol,
okay.
Funny enough.
Oh, okay, yeah. Cool. John?
I did a film degree, which okay. I guess is the other half.
Yeah.
But I'd also done a lot of... I took up diving when I was 16. I kind of got in that way in that I'd spent a lot of time in the water. I had a film degree, so I kind of combined those two sides. But obviously was obsessed with sharks as a child and loved marine biology, but one of the few people that doesn't have a zoology degree.
Okay, yeah. 2001, Blue Planet, to me, was the most mind-blowing piece of television ever, because I'm not a diver. It took me to places that I'm never going to go, and I think the same thing with Frozen Planet. Actually, it took me to a part of the universe, part of the world that I could never get to, and that's what makes it particularly special. Was that series important to you?
Oh yeah,
massively.
Yeah, I remember watching it. It was actually, I think I'd just started university and I'd just started diving in Northern Ireland the year before. So I'd been diving for a year and then all of a sudden this amazing underwater series just comes on, and I loved everything about it, from the music to the images to the story. It was just, you know, it was a real revelation to, I think, a lot of people that saw it. And having just started diving a year earlier, I just wanted to go and see all of those things. So, you know, in the last 12 years since I've been in Bristol, everyone thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if another series like Blue Planet happened? Never did we believe there would be another Blue Planet, and never did I believe I'd actually be working on it. Yeah. So, yeah, I remember very clearly sitting watching that.
John, you've been pretty quiet on this, but you worked on the music as well, didn't you?
I didn't work on the music. The music was all written by, you know, three fantastic composers, Hans Zimmer, David Fleming, and Jacob Shea. And obviously Jacob and Hans had worked on Planet Earth 2. It wasn't, you know, a foregone conclusion that we would use the same guys for our music. So we did look at other people, but Hans was actually very passionate about wanting to do this series. And whereas he wrote the theme for Planet Earth 2, he actually wrote a third of all of the cues in this series. My role in that was just from the production side. Obviously, you know, we want to have a cohesive score, and we've got our idea of what we want the music to be. So they write music and we just say, we love this, can we have a bit more of that, etc. So we'd be giving feedback, and just they would come back with even better music whenever we'd send it back. Gotcha. So the cues would come in, myself and the producers would watch it, and we'd feedback, and they would just make the cues even better.
Yeah. Are you planning a live show?
I have know nothing. I really don't. I hope so.
Yeah.
Because I loved the original Blue Planet live show.
That was amazing, wasn't it?
off the record.
So you guys were involved, weren't you?
Andrew did Blue Planet Live.
I heard you did.
So what
did
you do on Blue Planet Live? Because I went to. I remember.
Where did you go?
I went to. Was it Newcastle?
Did you?
No, this is the stupidest thing. I was such a George Fenton, and I loved the music in the original series so much.
Totally.
Both in Blue Planet, and they redid it for Deep Blue. Berlin Philharmonic, that was the first time they ever agreed to record a film score, was for Deep Blue. And that, to me, refined and improved. Not improved, but it just, it really brought the Blue Planet music out in the best possible way. So I remember I'd actually gone back from Bristol to Belfast for Christmas. But I flew from Belfast to Newcastle to see Blue Planet Live, and then back to Belfast for the rest of Christmas, and then back to Bristol. Yeah. So,
Thanks, Andrew.
What a way to experience the music.
Incredible. So I will speak about it briefly. So I was involved in that live show, and it did change my life. In the reason I wanted to do that live show was because I wanted to bring people to live orchestral music. That was my thing. It did that brilliantly. 50% of the people who came to those concerts had never been to a classical, or never booked for a classical concert before. And 50% of them then came back and went to see an orchestra without a screen and everything. So I knew it was doing that. But what also happened was it got me insanely fascinated with science and conservation and all that side of things. And then I thought, well, isn't that brilliant? You can combine science and the arts and bring people from both sides to a love of both. And it's ruined my life because that's all I do now is combine those two things.
In a shed.
In a shed,
I have an audio question. Various things written about the Foley, the sound effects. For the record, I really love it because audio pulls you in as much as the visuals. And I know that it's difficult to record things up close when you film them from far away. Now, with Blue Planet 2, you've got much better audio transmission underwater, and I don't know anything about what the audio in Blue Planet 2 is like.
One thing I will say is that the Reef episode worked really hard to do a lot of underwater recording. So that sort of dawn chorus that you hear on the Reef is, I believe, all natural to life. That's there is really, really cool. A dawn chorus on the Reef, a bit like you get in the rainforest, where everything kind of wakes up and starts sort of calling and clicking and whirring and... it's great to hear that sort of in reality, and it's very noisy. I mean, I think everyone sees the reef as this kind of like colourful, serene place, but it's not that at all. It's highly competitive and highly loud.
I was really surprised by that, actually. I thought reefs would be really quiet. I've always thought of them as being really...
No, they're totally like full of sound. You know, there's all these like snapping shrimp that they're constantly snapping their little claws away. That's how like they stun their prey. There's parrotfish that are crunching away on coral. There's like little damselfish that are squawking and chirping at each other. There's the anemone fish that are talking to each other. Well, they're making sounds at each other anyway. So yeah, they're super noisy places.
And when you're down there filming, you can hear that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you can certainly hear it. You do tend to sort of tune out of it after a while because it all sort of becomes quite similar, I guess. But certainly like... when you go from, like, you know, straight, as soon as you go into it, you definitely hear that, yes, there's all this, you know, squawking and clicking sort of sounds going on.
Yeah.
Oh. What's funny about that, actually, is I think more and more John can probably hear that better than us because he's on a rebreather. I think that makes a big difference.
It does make a big difference because whenever you're on scuba, all of the sounds are just getting obliterated by this cloud of bubbles that flies past your ears every time you breathe out. And on rebreathers, yeah, you start to realise just how many noises and sounds and things there are absolutely everywhere. Yeah. Until a bunch of tourist divers swim past and you can't hear anything.
John kindly referred to me as a steam train during our shoot for the Weedy Sea Dragons when I came down with my scuba kit.
Well, yeah, we were following these weedy sea dragons for 3 or 4 hours at a time, you know, on these rebreathers, so they had no idea we were there, and then Sophie turns up. But we got the sequence, so, you know.
Do you need to be specially trained to dive with a rebreather?
You do, because, you know, whenever you go in on scuba... if you're breathing, you know, generally, that's great. You know, there's something to breathe. The problem on a rebreather is, because it's a closed loop, there's always something to breathe. So what are you breathing? Is there enough oxygen? Is the carbon dioxide scrubber working and all of that? And you can dive with them very, very safely, but you do need to just train on them and you know the potential, you know, pitfalls with them. But when you're trained up and you've done enough hours, they are a remarkable piece of equipment that we couldn't have made the series without.
Speaking of which, I've tried scuba diving and it's amazing. It's like being in a different world. But in my amateur experience, it's really hard. Like there's a lot to think about, even just keeping your buoyancy, let alone tracking your tanks and your depth and your time and that sort of stuff. I guess it gets easier, but in terms of doing that whilst operating cameras and bearing everything else in mind that you have to look for, I don't know what the right question is. How hard is it? Or what's it like?
Yeah, I guess it's certainly one of the things, like, with underwater camera work is that, you know, most underwater camera people have done a lot of dives, you know, before that they even really maybe even pick up a camera or certainly get into it sort of on, you know, professional kind of level. So, you know, you're generally, like, really just comfortable with it, I guess. You know, it becomes very, like, very second nature, you know. You sort of just... Yeah, you sort of don't think about it anymore, really, you know, so it just sort of becomes an extension of you, and, you know, you're sort of gently, you know, maybe controlling your buoyancy just through your breathing, or, you know, if you have to, you know, sort of through, you know, adjusting your BC or whatever, so, Yeah, I think that just with lots of repetition, it does become easier.
We'll do some quick fire questions from year 8. Okay, here we go. How do you cope with being so deep in the ocean, and don't you get scared?
No, we don't get too scared.
Did you to begin with, though?
Yeah, definitely. First time underwater on scuba, yeah, it was scary. Well, maybe not scary, but like a really exciting experience. Anyway, it certainly wasn't the relaxed experience that scuba diving is now.
And sometimes you're still caught up in, okay, this is happening, we need to capture this, we need to do it justice, that your brain doesn't even let you think like that until after it's over, and you'll find yourself in bed that night going, oh wow, I was surrounded by a lot of big animals today. So you're just generally so focused that you don't really think like that.
Yeah, on the other hand as well, as I think, you know, sometimes we're not that deep. You know, a lot of the stuff we film from green seas, because you're in that kind of layer where, you know, green algae and plants are photosynthesizing, you're in the first 10 meters.
Yeah.
You know, and actually the great thing about rebreathers in those first 10 meters is you can sit there for 4 hours and...
Yeah.
But, you know, often you can stand up and you're out of the water.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So it's not, the interesting stuff isn't always deep, you know, where light penetrates, you get the most life.
Yeah. And this is a question which has come up quite a bit, so we should do it, which is, are you not scared about the sharks and the other creatures when you're in there?
I think that, like, I'd like to say that I have a healthy respect for sharks. Like, you know, I think that they're certainly not out there to get you. But on the other hand, they are a large animal that has big teeth, and I think that you need to treat them with respect, you know, be reading their moods, be reading what they're doing. So I think that we shouldn't ignore that fact. But no, I wouldn't say I'm really, you know, scared of them, but you do need to treat them with respect.
Okay.
And always take expert advice as well. You know, the thing is, if you talk to scientists who've worked with an animal before, you know, animals are individuals, they can always do unexpected things, but... They say generally with this shark you can do this or that. If this happens, you should back off. So it's always taking the expert advice on board. You know, some of the most important people we work with are those local guides and those local experts, because we turn up and we want to film a sequence for 3 weeks. These people have been in the water there for years, you know, and they've got so much knowledge, and without taking that from them, we wouldn't be able to do it. Because in that case, we would jump in the water and just get scared.
Yeah, absolutely. I have always found the oceans to be so completely awesome, in literally awesome. I find them kind of terrifying. Just, I feel awe, like, with nothing else. If I stand in front of a massive hull of a ship, it makes my heart beat faster. If I'm on a ship and I see a whale, it makes my heart beat faster. What's it like being in the water with a whale? Or several hundred whales.
Yeah, it's the most incredible experience in the world, and you know, it's very lucky. We're very lucky that we get to do it.
But, have you all been in the water with whales?
Yeah,
I have actually. Yeah, but not several hundred.
It's absolutely incredible. It's hard to put into words, and again, it's only that night whenever you start thinking about what you've seen that, you know, it really sinks in and you think, wow, what a fantastic experience that was. But we're always there doing a job, so whenever it's happening, you're actually thinking, oh dear, are we getting this?
Is this a big enough close up?
am I focusing?
And sometimes, you know, you've been there for 3 weeks looking for hopefully a specific thing, or something unexpected happens that you know is going to be great. So you're just thinking, well, I hope we get it, because, you know, it took 3 weeks to get this. We can't stay here for another 3 weeks. So, you know, that's the main thing that's going through.
Have
your
you
head.
Ever
like forgotten to charge the batteries?
or your audio recorder?
To be honest, our team are really good, but you know, sometimes you get technical faults you can't control. Sometimes for no reason a camera won't switch on, you know, and that's a horrible thing when it happens, and you have to breathe and deal with that technical problem before you even look at the behaviour that's going on, because there's no point if you can't film it.
And that's the other thing underwater is that. You know, filming on land, it's very easy. If your camera runs out of battery, you just put another one on. Underwater, it's all sealed up in an underwater housing. Yeah. So if you run out of battery, you've got to go back up to the boat, dry the housing, take the vacuum off the housing, open the housing, put another battery on, put the vacuum back in the housing, put your dive kit on and get in the water. So the chances that it's still going to be there whenever you get in
it's gone.
Unlikely. Sometimes, but not very often.
Ellie Jordan, asks, what is the most interesting species you have discovered so far, in your opinion?
I've never discovered a species, no. I have to be honest.
That would be pretty cool.
It would be amazing.
Yeah,
I mean, we don't discover anything, but to me, the octopus that was in Sunday's episode was one of the most amazing things for me, because it's actually called the common octopus.
Yeah.
Because it's so widespread. It's in most of the planet, that octopus. Lots of people have dived with it. Lots of people have studied it. But yet, in our sequence, there were two behaviours, the arms through the gills and the armouring, that, as far as we know, no one had ever seen before. So it's very humbling that even these very common species, if you spend time with them, you can still find new, exciting, interesting things about them. So it just makes you want to spend more time with other, you know, species that we arrogantly think we know everything about.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, I was very lucky to I guess film one of the many never seen before behaviours in this series, and that was the bird eating fish that was in in series one. And I mean, that was amazing. You know, I'm a massive fish fan, and it was one of those things that it truly was a fisherman's tale. It came from someone who had been on a fishing trip out to this very remote atoll in the Seychelles, and it was a conversation over a dinner party that trickled down to us. And as big a fan as I am of fish and big fish, and especially giant trevallies, I was incredibly sceptical.
Yeah, sure.
And after speaking to people, it gained more and more legs. And it was probably one of the riskiest sequences we filmed, because there'd never even been a photograph taken of it.
Mm.
So probably one of the only sequences we went out thinking, gosh, we might really, really get nothing.
Yeah.
But to see those fish is awe-inspiring. And I know John's a massive fan of sharks, but those guys, when they're in a pack, no shark is coming near them. They are the bosses of that atoll.
Have you heard that they've recorded, I believe, them like ramming sharks to death in papers? Yeah, so these fish will ram large sharks. I think it was actually a tiger shark. There's a paper about it. So they're pretty badass fish.
Yeah. It's amazing. My daughter, who you've just met, who's six, called Lyra, she came to the breakfast table one morning. She said, "Daddy, you won't believe what they told me in school. There's fish that eat birds." I was like, "What?" Because I hadn't seen the episode by that point. I was like, "There is a fish that eat birds. That's just nonsense." And then I watched it. I was like, "Blimey."
What? Well, I think that's our target audience, really. We want to inspire the next generation of marine biologists and underwater filmmakers. So,
good diving year, right?
Yeah, good job. Good job, everybody. Okay, thank you so much, everybody, for joining us here in the Cosmic Shed. And most importantly, thank you for making the television programme I've been waiting for since 2008.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you for listening. Bye.
Bye.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.